I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan talked of a new patriotism and said, "Let's make America great again." Since then, factors like increased terrorism, China's economic power, and multiple recessions have led to the ascendance of nationalist movements both here and in Europe. John Judas joins me to discuss his latest book, The Nationalist Revival: Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. Plus, this week, Dr. Lena Wen will leave her post as the health commissioner of Baltimore City to become the president of Planned Parenthood. I'll talk to Dr. Wen about what she's accomplished here and what still needs to be done to make Baltimore healthier and safer, and her priorities as she takes the helm of the largest organization in the country dedicated to reproductive health. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for tuning in. Before we begin today, we note the passing of a Maryland political icon. Former Senator Joe Tidings passed away yesterday. He was a close ally of the Kennedys, a progressive voice in Annapolis in the House of Delegates and in Washington, where he served for one term in the U.S. Senate. Our colleague Sheila Cast interviewed Senator Tidings and his biographer John Friess in August on her program, On the Record. You can find that terrific conversation on the WIPR website. Joe Tidings was 90 years old. Coming up a little later today on Midday, Dr. Lena Wen joins me on Friday. She's leaving her post as the health commissioner of Baltimore City to lead Planned Parenthood. She'll be here a little bit later in the program, but we begin today with a conversation about the rise of nationalism as a political movement. Brazil is holding a runoff election at the end of the month following the near victory of Jair Bolsonaro, an admirer of some of Brazil's past dictators. Several countries in Europe have seen a far-right brand of nationalism ascendant in recent years, and of course, Donald Trump's doctrine of America First was a key ingredient to his electoral victory in 2016. My guest is John Judas, who trains his gaze on the rise of nationalism in his latest book. John Judas is a former senior editor at The New Republic. He's an editor-at-large at Talking Points Memo and the author of 7 books. The new one is called The Nationalist Revival: Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. If you have a comment or a question for John Judas about nationalization, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To catch us on Twitter, @MiddayWIPR. You can also tune in to the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. John, welcome back. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to be here.
So there's an awful lot packed into this book. And let's begin by talking about the distinction between nationalism and globalism.
Well,
because sometimes people use those terms kind of.
You mean as they use them as opposites?
As opposites, yeah.
You know? I think the main thing I'd say is that what we're seeing now, the rise of nationalist parties and candidates, chiefly Donald Trump, is partly a reaction to globalization. Globalization is different. I distinguish from internationalism. Mm-hmm. It's really the subordination of nations to international organizations and to the international market, to the economic free market. That goes beyond the kind of institutions that we had after World War II, where countries ceded part of their sovereignty, but they didn't let it rip the way the membership in the, for instance, the World Trade Organization is involved, where there's the disputes are settled by a body from the World Trade Organization. So we've had since the 1990s, if not before, this kind of movement beyond what was internationalism towards globalization. And I think that's part of what's triggered this nationalist reaction in the United States and Europe.
And would you consider them polar opposites then? The nationalist movement premised in, you know, isolationism, in a concern only for the well-being and the market functions of the one country, the country of your origin, as opposed to wanting to play on the larger global stage?
No. Let's back up for a minute, because you know part of the thing with nationalism is that after World War II, there was this enormous, predictable, and understandable reaction to nationalism itself, as identified with Hitler, Mussolini. If you go back in American history, for instance, Abraham Lincoln was a nationalist. Theodore Roosevelt was a nationalist. It appears on both the left, the right, and the center politically. And sometimes it's accompanied by some kinds of internet. It's not isolationism, and sometimes it is. So I think you have to be careful. And that's important now, because a lot of the reaction to these nationalist parties arising in Europe and the United States is to say, well, we have to have the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't fight with China about trade relations at all. If Trump wants it, then it's got to be wrong. So I think what I was concerned with in the book is trying to detach nationalism from the kind of understanding that arose after World War II, and that's still very prevalent, that it's something bad in itself.
The book you wrote prior to this one was about populism.
Yeah.
Is there a definite connection between populism? Because Mr. Trump is called, you know, the billionaire populist. And
yes.
Is there a connection between populism and nationalism?
Yes, a lot. Populism, you could say, is a kind of political logic. Nationalism defines a program, an approach. I think one of the differences is that nationalism itself is based fundamentally on sentiment. It's a social psychology. It's something we feel. You know, the one way you could think of it is, this is Baltimore, so a lot of people are Baltimore Ravens fans, and they get unhappy when the team loses and when they get that happy when the team wins. And it's irrational. Who cares? It's just a game. Sometimes, to some extent, even our feelings about our nation are like that. We get happy when it does well. We get very unhappy when it doesn't. There's a basic kind of sentiment underlying it. Now, populism, liberalism, socialism, those are all political ideologies. But nationalism is something very basic. So I guess that's the distinction. But again, a lot of the populist parties now have nationalist appeal.
Because you write that the book's underlying political identity or political agenda in this book is to identify and reclaim what is valid about nationalism. I guess that's because nationalism is often, at least now in this current political moment, associated with these far
right
political ideologies, both here and in Europe.
Yeah, look, you can't have democracy in the modern world without nationalism. Without a sense among the people that they have a common citizenship, that even though a person might live, a thousand miles away and you've never seen the person, that person has an equal right to vote in an election because they're also citizens. There's a basic we as opposed to they that underlies democracy. Even the modern welfare state, you pay taxes to support somebody who might be unemployed in Miami, Florida, that you've never set eyes upon. Now, in order to accept that, you have to accept that that person is part of your nation, part of your we. So it's a kind of fundamental thing. It's nothing. There's nothing wrong with it. Now,
of course, a lot of people accept that rather grudgingly.
Well, when they don't accept it, when you have a feeling that people aren't part of the we, when they're, let's say, illegal immigrants who are getting welfare undeservedly from your standpoint, then a nation starts being in trouble. When you have a separatist movement like you have in Spain, where people say, well, you know, Catalonia is not really part of Spain, that's exactly when a nation gets in trouble. So, yeah, it's an essential prerequisite for a country working well. Now, you know, it can also be the basis for fascism, authoritarianism. It can go in different directions. But what I'm trying to do is disentangle it from this kind of knee-jerk reaction that it's bad in itself.
You observe that there are three kinds of appeals to nationalism. And it was interesting. They struck me as three very disparate things. The first is uniting a nation against a particular foreign foe, or perhaps a colonial power. The second is terrorism. And the third is China as an economic powerhouse in the world. And then, of course, the Great Recession. Immigration is you know, bollocksed up at all of that as well. But that's sort of I wouldn't have thought that those three or four things are related in some way. But how are these nationalist appeals presented then in those
okay,
contexts?
So let me try to unpack this. And let's just talk for a moment about the United States, not about Europe or Brazil or anything else. You really have two things that are driving the current nationalism, American first sentiment. One thing is economic. It's the hollowing out of the middle class, the loss of 4.2 million manufacturing jobs over the last 10 years or 20 years. And that's created in the United States and also as well in Europe, a kind of a group of people left behind that feel that they don't have that they don't have a future, and they're worried about their children, if not themselves. Secondly, you have immigration. Massive immigration in the United States begins in 1965, accelerates after 1990. Europe, you have asylum, refugees, and that's fused with Islamic terrorism, the fear of terrorism. So you have people not only worried about people coming in who have a different culture, who don't speak the same language, who might be competing for jobs, who might be taking social benefits and taxes that you have to pay for them. But you also have people worried that they're going to throw a bomb in your shopping mall or, you know, a riot on New Year's Eve. So you combine all those things. What you really have is people feeling that there's a threat to their way of life. So the economic and cultural thing is related in this way, that it's exactly those people who feel left behind who become the focus, the center of the anxiety about the loss of way of life, of immigration, of refugees coming in, of increased crime and so forth. So that's the connection. And, you know, when China figures, because China has been the main source of job loss in the United States in the manufacturing sector particular.
John Judas, the book is called The Nationalist Revival: Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. John Judas will be speaking at the Ivy Bookshop tonight. We'll have information about that on our website. John, you write about the other dichotomies, nationalists and cosmopolitans. One of the analysts of the Brexit vote in England called them somewheres and anywheres, and he uses those terms as well.
Right.
So we see this rural, exurban divide politically in the United States between them and people who live in larger cities. Secretary Clinton carried the cities. Mr. Trump carried the rural and exurbia areas of the country. That's a fundamental tension, isn't it?
People who are
comfortable.
Fundamental in the United States, also in Europe. Budapest versus the surroundings, Warsaw, the big cities in Poland surround the main prosperous centers in Germany versus the older Eastern Europe. German part of Germany, northern France versus Paris. It's fundamental. And the distinction is something like this. We all have some allegiance to the nation. Well, there's some people, again, who were kind of world citizens, you could say. But, you know, for the most part, people who grow up in a country have a loyalty, defend it in the case of attack, and so on. But for people who've lost a lot of their surroundings, their communities, their source of identity, the local bar, the factory that their family worked at for generations after generations. The identification with nation becomes much more important than, say, a professor at NYU who's a member of a professional association, who has all these valued books, who travels around the world, who's cosmopolitan in that sense. It doesn't, he or she would still want to defend America if it were attacked, but doesn't see that as important. The person for whom nation is very important, for instance, sees the National Football League protest. It's just desecration. For someone like myself, it's a political issue, but it doesn't go to my heartstrings. So I think that's the difference. It's a basic difference. And part of the problem with our politics is that it's increasingly dividing along those lines, Democrats versus Republicans. The 2016 election with Hillary Clinton and the deplorables was understood by many people exactly along those lines.
And President Trump, as a candidate and continuing as the president, often, I think, uses, it seems, as one of the metrics of this divide and this problem, trade deficits. So we have a trade war going on with China. There's a front page headline in the Wall Street Journal today that the strains between the United States and China are deepening. There doesn't seem to be any end in sight in that particular conversation. But how important are trade deficits? I hear varying opinions about this. I mean, are trade deficits valid metrics for whether or not one country's doing okay and another's doing less okay?
Yes and no. For a country that
you're no help. Everybody,
no, I know. Does everybody say that?
No, yeah, but because it really seems like there's a lot of varying opinion about whether trade deficits are the problem that the president presents them as, and other economists are saying no, they're fine. They're a sign of health in a lot of ways.
Look, the thing about the United States is a dollar is the universal currency. We can run deficits, and other countries will finance it. We can run trade deficits, and it's fine because other countries want to hold dollars. They need them to buy other things. In other words, Thailand needs dollars to buy things from Cambodia. So they're not worried if they have an excess of dollars. On the other hand, if you're a little country and you're running big trade deficits, you're in big trouble because how are you going to buy things from other people? Now, having said that, the trade deficits in manufacturing and in advanced manufacturing, computers, electronics, and stuff like that, is important. And those are respects in which the United States has fallen behind. And we are in a position where we're vulnerable, where we have to buy a lot of things that we should make ourselves from other people in other countries. So that's the yes and no part of it. Trump takes a more, I think, just purely quantitative approach to it. And that's a mistake, in my opinion. But it's not a mistake to worry about certain kinds of trade deficits.
But you also write that, for example, the Great Recession was animated in part by taking all of these dollars that were shipped back to the United States from foreign trade surpluses, and instead of having them invested in manufacturing enterprises, they're put in real estate and the stock market.
Yeah, that's exactly. And that's, again, that when we embarked upon this kind of globalization in the 1990s, people expected all kinds of things. They expected it would make the world economy more stable. They expected that it would lead China towards becoming more democratic and free market. They expected jobs in the United States. A lot of these promises were not kept.
China joined the World Trade Organization in 1995.
Right? No, they joined it in 2001.
Okay.
But we were a major force.
Started in 1995, maybe.
Yes, right? Yes.
And so I guess folks thought, well, once they're in the WTO, then they're going to just, get in line with everybody else.
Yes.
That hadn't happened, has it?
That didn't happen. And the WTO did not cover currency, which is the main problem that we had in that decade in terms of Chinese goods underpricing American goods and leading to a lot of ghost towns in the Middle West and also in the South.
What's the best way to achieve the right balance then? Because you write, for example, that the Center for American Progress has analyzed things as saying that immigrants, when we talk about immigration and jobs and in the United States, immigrants complement native-born workers and increase the standard of living. But you say that that statement is as implausible on the surface as any put forward by climate change deniers or Tea Party enthusiasts. I mean, are immigrants taking American jobs? And are immigrants, as a general rule, you know, good, bad, or neutral when it comes to the economy?
Well, what happens with, the question of wages is, if you look at the overall average wages in the United States and immigrants, the average has gone up. But that's not the key thing. A lot of unskilled or lower skilled industries and occupations in construction, meatpacking, janitorial services have become down. The wages have gone from mid-wage to low-wage. Unions have been kicked out, especially in meatpacking. And so there is an effect. And what we've had in the United States is an enormous influx of unskilled laborers who primarily affect detrimentally the unskilled labor kids who didn't go beyond high school or even there in the United States, and they're really the people that we should worry about. You know, if you live in a fancy suburbs or a city, you know, for you an immigrant means might mean a nanny or somebody who does your lawn at a lower price. If you live in a little town in Iowa that used to make its living by meatpacking, it's the experience is a lot different. So I'm not for ending immigration or anything like that, but I think we have to be sensitive to the economic effects, and that's again part of understanding what we need to do as a nation.
Because there are economists who say there's two ways to grow the economy: you have the people in the economy produce more, or you have more people in the economy producing whatever they produce. So he was arguing, and this is the president of the Federal Reserve in Minneapolis, I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about this a few months back. He was saying, you know, our borders should be much more open than they are, because the more people we bring in, the greater gain for the collective good is going to be undeniable. I mean, how does one find the balance between
It always amazes me that these economists, you know, for 100 years, 200 years, they're talking about the law of supply and demand. If you have an oversupply of labor, then it's going to drive down wages and working conditions. It put workers at a disadvantage. It makes it impossible to have unions. Now, again, there's very skilled labor that comes in that works in very special jobs. It has a different effect. But again, in the United States, maybe half to two-thirds has been low-skilled labor. So, again, I'm very skeptical of those kind of projections.
You write about the culture wars that the United States has endured over really the last 50 years. This week with the Kavanaugh hearings, were we witnessing yet another culture war? Was this a political divide? Was this a divide, Republican-Democratic divide based on what we at one time thought were sort of predictable principles in both of those parties? How did you read it?
Boy, I didn't expect to have to talk about this. look, I'm entirely sympathetic to Christine Blasey Ford's testimony, and I wish that Kavanaugh had not been confirmed for a whole variety of reasons that even go beyond that. But I think it does reinforce the culture wars, and I think that we're going to see, to some extent, in 2018, a repeat of the kind of differences we saw in 2016 over, again, a sense that a lot of Americans have that these things are going on in these metro areas, and people are concerned about them, and they don't understand our needs. You know, it's raised a whole lot of political stakes for Republicans, and they feel now they have to defend their turf. Yeah. So you see that in polls in a lot of the Senate races, that Republican candidates in, let's say, North Dakota are now in much better shape than they were before. So, yeah, it's rekindled these culture wars.
Well, both the book on populism and this new one on nationalism I found really fascinating and beautifully argued. So I appreciate both of those books and appreciate your coming in today to talk about them.
Sure. I'm happy to be here.
John Judas, the book is called, the latest one is called The Nationalist Revival, Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. John Judas will be speaking about his new book at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road in North Baltimore tonight at 7 o'clock. And we've got a link with details to that event on our website, wypr.org/midday. Coming up, Dr. Lena Wen joins me. She's about to take the reins of Planned Parenthood after nearly 4 years as the health commissioner of Baltimore City. She joins me here in Studio A when we come back from a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.